Welcome back, Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Complicated times out there. It's going to require some sophisticated techniques. So come and get your learn on. It's time to up your game. I'm Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, escaped professor, late night comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. You can find me over at Substack if you're looking for content. I sell tasty newsletters over there, like Persuasion for Parents. Tired of yelling at your kids? Well, move them around with better words. An interesting one. On the podcast, I talk to comedians about their politics. That's the first thing I do because they're interesting minds. I also convert conservatives. Send me a conservative. We'll talk. And I glean persuasion advice from people who do persuasion for a living in many different formats, especially rhetoricians. I interview a lot of academic rhetoricians on here. More rhetoricians on this podcast than any other. That's my big claim. Today is another episode of Persuasion Pros. And I would have to say my guest today is a super example of what you can actually do with an English degree. I tell people all the time, no, you can use those things. He's done a range of interesting work in the writing and content space. Currently director of content marketing for All Campus, which he'll talk about among many other things. Bryant Harland. Bryant.
Hey, how's it going, Dan?
I'm good, man. I'm not living the exciting TARDIS life like you are, but
you know it was a very, like, they teach you in media training, because I learned this from my work at a research agency, speaking of many things that I've done, that you should, like, set the tone and make it, like, neutral and, you know, safe, something people are familiar with. So insider tip, a trip would be something else. That's not legal for, like, another 5 years, actually. Only in Oregon.
Only in the why Oregon? I wonder why Oregon got that passed.
A lot of research going on in that area, I think. It's a big, like, mental health kind of thing. So yeah, you know, I've done a lot of different things, but if you want to go back to it, like you said, you know, I got started with, you know, an English degree. I got started as a writer back in the early days of 2009, before a lot of things have happened. Yeah, my entire industry has, like, transformed several times over. That's one of the, you know, magical things about marketing is, you know, the stuff you learn today might be gone tomorrow.
Yeah, I've worked in marketing, I guess, the last 7 years roughly. And it's, yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. Like, 1 week to the next, you're like, oh, this is going to work. Oh, look at that. It doesn't. Huh.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's really kind of funny. And that's, you know, I think my career trajectory is really what kind of, like, drew me to your podcast. And now, for, you know, context for listeners, we have communicated in total maybe an hour. I think people get this, like, weird idea that professional networking has to be this really complex and elaborate thing. No, Dan and I have spoken to each other maybe 40 minutes leading up to this point. That's all it was.
Yeah. And it was a random lunch club meeting, right?
Yeah, I know. Just like, you know, I was doing market research and I wanted a break, and I was like, hey, Lunch Club's got stuff going on. Let's see what's out there.
Yeah. You talk about changes coming along. To me, Lunch Club's a fascinating evolution between live talk, or at least Zoom talk, and social media, because you're just slamming into people, you know, across the world for 10, 15, 20 minute conversations. And it's amazing. Like, the range of skills, the range of personalities, but it kind of works. Within the world of Lunch Club, within the rules of Lunch Club, it kind of works.
Yeah, I think it, like, really fits, you know, a need too that I've been seeing across basically every technology and media and, like, marketing and business sector everywhere, which is, you know, people are really fed up with marketing. sorry, I am really sorry, other marketers, business people, nobody likes listening to you. That's just the way it is. And, you know,
well, shoving bland or sales content into the world's not a good form of communication. Well,
exactly. You know, that's exactly what I mean is people have caught on to, like, the business bullshit game of marketing, and they understand it now, and they're talking about it on social media and, you know, all of those other places. So there's, you know, we talk a lot about, like, data privacy and things, and the reverse end of that is, yes, businesses have all our data, but we also have way more visibility into the way business operates and the way organizations are run. And if you teach people how to take advantage of that, you can change the world, Dan.
I'm in for it. Let's change the world with that. That sounds good. Will you run that? I'll be right in there doing some work.
You know, I might have a few ideas along that. Give me like 5 years to lay down the base infrastructure for it. And, you know, maybe we'll do a follow-up episode on the podcast.
Yeah, it's funny. I had a really interesting talk the other day with a guy from St. Louis who works in crypto, and he and a partner founded a crypto agency, and I made him explain crypto to me. And this guy was super sharp and super fast and communicative. And I'm like, oh, I think I get it. But it was the same thing. Like, he's like, oh, it's the doorway into utopia. And I almost believe him. I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. You want to be careful with technology people as well, because much like business people, they understand that most people don't understand their jargon. And they use that to their advantage. The easiest way to tell if a technology salesperson is bullshitting you is just start asking them questions. It works across like marketing, sales, services, anything.
You like pull them off their script and watch what happens.
Yeah. Well, that's the fun thing, you know, as now a business leader who has a history as a freelance writer, when I want to work with content marketing agencies, one of the first questions I'll ask them is, how much do you pay your writers? Before a salesperson gives me a business or service pitch, because how they treat the production staff and the creative talent tells me everything I need to know about what quality of work they do.
Yeah, I call that a deconstruction question, like where you ask a question that just pierces through the ribs and they're suddenly like, if I tell you that, that's going to be complete transparency of who we are. Like, yeah, that's the point. Yeah.
See, that's really cool and actually relates to something else I was thinking about just before we got started. You know, I like to play around with the way language is used and perceived by the media. And one of the things that I think a lot about, because my day job, I work in the education space, and just, you know, the way people learn and, you know, what people think about formal education. One of the issues that I've recognized, you know, just across the industry, is that people don't realize they can learn a lot outside of formal education. Like, formal education can help, like the Kickstarter. But you can learn a lot outside of that. Good example is, you know, I chose the topics I wanted to talk about on this podcast because, you know, I went and read your blog and listened to one of the episodes. It was Emily, what's her last name? The Multipotentialite.
Oh, Emily Carpenter.
Yeah. And I listened to that and I was like, hey, I know what Dan likes to talk about. Let's go.
Damn, you know what I like to talk about? Would you send me a sample
of what you like to talk about?
Yeah,
you like to cause trouble in a playful way.
That's a good. I could handle that. That tagline causes trouble in a friendly way.
Do you want a like very clear cut example of this?
Do it.
All right. Just as a disclaimer, I'm going to spell out your game to everyone. Are you ready for it?
I'm fully transparent. People can see my game. I'll tell them my game, but I'd love to hear your version of my game.
All right. Perfectly. So you are like, I don't know, a meta rhetorician at this point, because you've created a resource hub for people who like persuading other people and people who've made it their life's work to persuade other people. That means if you invite people to your podcast, they will promote themselves, and then you don't have to do as much work promoting your podcast. But also, the reason it works for you is that your course is very affordable, and you have a lot of different ways of like engaging. Like, for people who want to spend the money and get like a real-time coach, you know, they can pay a little bit more. For people who just want like a refresher on rhetoric or like, you know, some food for thought, they can pay $25 for, you know, a really quick and easy certificate course, basically. And I think, you know, that's why you're able to be like, here's who I am, I don't care, you know, because you're offering something that people care about and that they would value.
Well done. Nice. I like it.
Yeah. Summary of my career, that's what I walk into companies and do for like entire brands. With one person, it's a lot easier because you have a lot fewer stakeholders to make happy, ethically persuade, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I have this thing too where I tell everybody, I offer them the chance of being audited. Do you want me to speed audit you? your communication. And I'm like, just be ready. I won't tear people apart unless they pissed me off for some reason in a lunch club talk, which happens every once in a while when somebody's trying to sell me. Like
That was a good example of throwing shade. Good job.
I'll give them a chance. I'll give them a chance, you know, to back away from their vehicle. But if they don't, I'll just shred them.
Yeah. I love it.
But I think this idea of being able to audit someone's communication, someone's tactics and things like that, people don't get that feedback very often. And if you can do it in a coherent, fast, communicative way, like you just did, not a particularly negative way, you can find negatives too, but it's like a super offer to people. They'd never get that.
Yeah. Do you want to do a live case study of how I would deliver critical feedback?
Sure, man. Awesome. It's your podcast. You do whatever you want.
Let's go. Folks,
you're the smartest. You have the cool background. You run this show.
Folks, this is now the combination podcast marketing communications case study live from the TARDIS. So you know what I like about the Rhetoric Warriors website, Dan?
What's that?
It is not shy about a call to action. Some clients I work with, they're a little shy about sticking a button on there that tells people where to go and what to do. Not rhetoricwarriors.com. If you go into the course there, there's not one, there's not two, there are not three call to action buttons that all lead to the form that pays Dan French $25. There's nine. And that is really impressive because some people are shy. You are not.
No, I'm definitely not a shy rhetorician. I will tell you what to do.
Yeah, exactly. Here's how I would elevate that. Spice it up with a little bit of content in between, you know, maybe experiment with different calls to action. You know, if you really wanted to get fancy, you could add some fields on your form for like, don't want to be a rhetoric warrior. What if you were a rhetoric witch? What if you were a rhetoric paladin? That's probably just a synonym for grammar Nazi now that I think about it.
But no,
but if you really want to be a rhetoric paladin, you know, there you go. And then you can personalize your marketing. You can hire like an email team when you really get up and rolling, you know? So, yeah. You know, it's that easy. Like, you know, I took something I liked about Dan's site and I was like, you know, this is great. I love it. It's a little bit different. Here's how I would take it to the next level. Dan's free to take the feedback or not.
Yeah, I think that notion of, I have an improvement obsession. And yeah. I love development, like in Hollywood. And what I've always enjoyed about doing comedy writing, especially stand-up is the ultimate development game. Like you come up with a flash idea of something you think that's funny. Like I looked at the cough syrup a couple weeks ago online, Formula 44, just popped up on my feed somewhere. And I'm like, well, what happened to the other 43 formulas?
That's like, pretty good.
That's a lot of failure to get to one formula.
You know, you've actually discovered the formula to creativity, Dan, because do you know where I come up with all my best ideas? Certainly not at work. I came up with everything I wanted to talk about on this podcast while I was getting high in a hammock on Saturday, basically. That's it.
High in a hammock. I think that sounds like a really good podcast right there.
Now, the important
part... people get in the hammock and you record that them getting high in the hammock and talk.
You know, the content team over at All Campus and I have been playing around with this idea, right? Take the model of drunk history, apply it to literature or whatever your favorite field is. You know, folks, if you have an interest, go wild.
Yeah, adding drunkenness into stuff is an interesting creative hook.
Now, the important part about drunk history nobody tells you about is later they have editors to make sure that they're telling a cohesive story. So keep that in mind as you're creating your drunk whatever spinoffs, hire good editors.
Well, I've taught a lot of comedy workshops and people always come in wanting to get into stand up. And they're like, I think I'm going to have to drink, you know, first to get up on stage. I'm like, no, that's a pro technique. You don't want to be drunk.
Yeah.
Trust me.
Yeah, you definitely want to do a few practice runs before you go live. Nobody jumps to like, what is it, Ron White? Was that the guy?
Yeah, Ron White's kind of a famous drunk, but
yeah.
You know, he'd done stand-up for 20 years before he ever got real exposure. And at that point, your script is burned in your brain no matter how drunk you are.
Yeah, exactly. At that point, it's like muscle memory. You're just remembering things.
Yeah, going back to your read on like rhetoric warriors, it's kind of fascinating to understand, and I do this a lot with people as well, like here's a professional level message that you're used to seeing. Like your TARDIS background there was clearly built by people who do art and special effects and yada, yada. Some pro team put that together. And now you just grab it and use it. Yeah. But you get the value add of that professionalism. And that's what everybody's used to seeing. They're not used to seeing one person. And my co-partner in the marketing agency here in Austin put together the website for Rhetoric Warriors off a template, and we just burned through it. So it's only two people. And the fact that it's as competent as it is pretty amazing. But if you're used to seeing professional product and you see something that's a little bit below that, you notice the little bit below that because you are trained as a consumer to see only perfection.
Yeah. I'm going to say one thing in the near future, and I just want to preface this by saying I really hate asshole atheists, but there's an idea that Richard Dawkins came up with that I really like, and it's the way that he describes how memes work. And basically he just compares it like a virus. It's like an idea that just kind of pervades the cultural consciousness. So if you think like any really common meme from, you know, even 20 years ago, how old is Rick Rolling? I don't know. Time, ADHD, it makes no sense. That's why we're in the TARDIS, because I have no conception of time. But anyway, once you develop a media franchise like that, your fans and your communities can use it to communicate. And now, as an example, there's not a 100% overlap between these two communities. However, you will find a lot of overlap between the following two communities. Doctor Who fans and queer people, because nerds used to be, you know, pretty stigmatized. Queer people are still fairly stigmatized. And so there's a commonality of like experience there. And so that's like why memes are powerful, essentially.
Plus it's Doctor Who, so it's vague.
Yeah, and it's good and soundbitey. Like you can come up with like a million marketing spins and buzz phrases based on it. Like, you know, if you adapt other media for your own, you've like skipped half the work. It's really great.
Well, he also, Doctor Who also changes identity, right? I mean, so it fits within queer communities and trans communities and everything else. Like they're, all those themes are in that fiction.
Yeah. Actually, if you want a really good supplemental podcast on queer community and history is gay podcast. Basically, it's just an analysis of like famous literary people who were either implied to be gay or very obviously gay, because there's a range. There's like Virginia Woolf is a good example. She was a queer writer, and not many people know about it, because a lot of it was just like personal letters to her lovers and, you know, people that she had on the side in addition to her spouse.
Why people were afraid of her?
Everyone except for Vita Sackville West was afraid of Virginia Woolf. Those of you in the BDSM community will understand what I mean.
So should it be who's not afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Exactly.
Smaller subset.
Well, we're now on the Vita Sackville West fan podcast. but the point is, you know, if you look for members of your community and you understand the language and the media that resonates with them, you can find them and you can find people to connect with. As a fun example, if you are a queer business person and you want to know who the other queer allies in your organization are, just start talking about Ashnikko long enough and look for the people who look mildly embarrassed.
I've seen this in Austin quite a bit, like with the BDSM community here. I have a friend who's in it, and we were at a party sometime, and I could just tell like there was somebody else there that she knew was in it and she couldn't acknowledge it, but they were acknowledging it. It's pretty interesting, all the subcultures as they move within the major cultures.
Yeah. You know the other dirty secret of the B2B technology industry, Dan?
I don't. What is it?
Every technology trade show, there's the public trade show, And then there's the trade show that happens in like hotel rooms and things everywhere. Because it turns out if you get a bunch of geeks and nerds together for like a weekend, they like to have a good time.
Well, yeah, humans seem to do that. They seem to have their work, and then they seem to like transition through some type of drug state, usually alcohol, whatever it is. And then they have their social life. Yeah, the drug state is the moat between work and the social. Yeah.
That's actually an interesting point, because it also ties into, I think, one of our biggest problems as a society is people don't know, don't have the information they need to use drugs healthily. Because it's another stigmatized thing with a lot of rhetorical lies involved in the process. Yeah, I know. Weird.
Rhetoric and lies.
Yeah, I know.
That doesn't exist.
Dan, what if I told you that the war on drugs was racist?
Racist? Yeah, against drugs. It's totally racist against drugs.
You know, I know something hilarious from like my background. This is a personal story, so be prepared. I was always pegged as a stoner, like way, way before marijuana was legal. And I didn't always smoke.
Is it the sleepy eyes?
It's the sleepy eyes. I've always had a little bit longish hair, you know, baggy clothes, you know, teenage edgelord. I shopped at Hot Topic.
You just captured a whole swath of America right there.
That's the real secret of marketing, folks. Just identify your cross sections and then market to as many of them as possible,
and just be your cross section.
Be the most authentic version of yourself, and the people who are into you will just kind of, you know, find you.
That authenticity thing, man, it gets battered and knocked around. Like in stand up again, people were always like, find your authentic voice. And I think you did, and it's boring.
Like, yeah, your authentic voice is
mediocre.
Well, see, it's a complex issue that goes back into feedback. Once you find your authentic voice, you should get somebody else's feedback on that voice and then refine it.
Right. Development. You got to go through development. America, humanity, development. Yeah. Remember that word.
Yeah. And that's the other thing is me being on this podcast right now. Development, because I'm getting practice being on podcasts. It's not something I've done a lot of. You know, I've been a public speaker before. I've been in a lot of different, you know, trade shows and things. Not a whole lot of podcasts, you know, one or two. So this is just like,
do you want feedback?
Sure, let's go.
We're trading feedback. So far, what are we, 20 minutes in, something like that?
Yeah.
You're great. You're ADD, ADHD, guesty, which means we're bouncing like ping pong balls across topics, which I think is awesome. I love those conversations. So that's my first note, is that I would place you not as a linear guest. You're what's called in the logic world an abductive guest. Do you know what abduction is?
It's related to kidnapping. Like,
it is.
It's like a legal term for kidnapping, isn't it?
But it's one of those cool pliable words that means something completely different too. So there's induction, there's deduction, which is linear truth. Like, you only go from everything has to be true in order to move to the next thing. So deductive principles. Inductive, where it's probably true, highly likely, you're grabbing case studies and everything else and getting close to truth with everything you say. Abductive is you make your best guess really fast from a lot of different things because your brain makes connections. And abductive thinkers, like, they can be ADD, or ADHD, but they're not necessarily, they're just multi-aware, and they can make connections between things really fast. You're an abductor.
Why, thank you. That's awesome. You know, businesses could really use like frameworks around, you know, describing how people connect and interact like that, I think, because what I have found is that people who need to lead businesses think very differently from each other, which is good. However, they don't always think about the adjustments they need to make when they're communicating and collaborating with each other, which is bad. And a lot of that problem is, you know, the language of business and the language of academia is very separate. However, you know, through the glory of partnerships and professional networking and, you know, talking about things we care about on podcasts, we can share a lot of knowledge and learn from each other. And so, like, it goes back to learning. If I had advice for young writers, young business people, old business people, veterans, retired people, doesn't matter. You know, take the time, learn to think about not just like who you are and what you value, but how you articulate those things to the world. And then that informs everything else you do, you know, who you work with, whose podcasts you show up on, whether or not you hire a shitty content mill or you hire a, you know, more expensive but higher quality agency. Another good example of throwing shade, by the way. For listeners that may not know, there's a very definite difference between throwing shade and calling somebody out. Calling somebody out, everyone knows who you're talking about. Throwing shade, four people, maybe 10 people max know who you're talking about, but most people will know that shade has been thrown.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting art form for sure. I plucked three words out of what you said while you were going through that nice run of advice for people, which was learn to think. Like everybody gets that advice, I think at some point, like learn. To me, like learn to think and then learn to do rhetoric are the sort of the co-pairs and the stuff that people never really get. People never really get trained how to think. Just because your brain works, even if it seems to work rationally, does not mean that it's working optimally within the software that you've been given. Like people don't understand logic. They don't. Like the thing I just told you, inductive, deductive, abductive, 99% of the world has never heard abductive logic. And it's just one of those things that when you drop it on people, it has such intuitive truth. They're like, oh yeah, because some people can't do abductive thinking. They can only do linear thinking. And so when you throw this creative new idea in there or something like the Formula 44 thing, the reason I could get there is that I look at the 44 instead of it all as this sort of innocuous brand. I break it apart and I'll go into that symbol and there's more in there, but that's abductive thinking, kind of inductive thinking too, but nobody gets trained in this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many factors. I don't even know where to begin. The business sector is like contributing, the media sector is contributing, you know, politics. actually,
you're contributing. You are now contributing.
Yeah, I know.
Now in the conversation.
I know. I've just made things more complex.
Good.
That's the thing is complexity doesn't necessarily mean bad.
It doesn't mean confusing. Complexity does not need to mean confusion. That's the problem is that if it gets confusing, you're not thinking well.
Yeah. See, if you get enough people in a room and they're all receptive to feedback and like come from different areas of expertise, you can solve almost any problem. You know, maybe any problem. I don't know. Nobody's ever tried it on the scale that it would take to solve a lot of our problems before. But, you know, if you're an innovative think tank, try it out.
Yeah, I agree. So we're starting our innovative think tank here. Well, you and I will be the founding members of the innovative think tank. We need to come up with a name. Innovative think tank, ITK.
I mean, the Rhetoric Warrior Cinematic Universe.
Yeah. Because
that gives us a platform. Any service we want to include can technically be a Rhetoric Warrior service. Doesn't matter what it is. You want to be a tech and media agency? Let's go. You want to be an education institution? Let's go.
Yeah, that's kind of the idea, right? That when you, and that's why my book was 21 Colosseums, because you start to see the world not as one big collusion, but as separate areas, and then you can do work on it. So if I know that I'm going to go into a religious setting and try to do a religious persuasion within that setting, I can localize my techniques from all these other areas and bring them over to religion and adapt them. But if you don't realize that you're now like you're talking about, if you're talking to a very conservative business versus a very innovative or, you know, like you're saying, queer friendly business, you can pull up different types of rhetoric and you should for those different, you know, settings.
Yeah, that's a great point. I've been thinking a lot about that too. It's like you have also learned from me and know what I care about. It's weird how that happens.
Oh, it's the TARDIS, man. You're sending out waves of intelligent information. Folks,
this is what happens when you get two masters of rhetoric and or marketing together. The void looks back.
Yeah, I know. People, I love to study conversation. And every once in a while, there's a rule in general culture, in the general social contract, you're not supposed to give people feedback, direct feedback, especially negative feedback about their communication abilities.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't work at all in communication studies.
Yeah.
You know? And so I do it to people all the time. And I can do it where I can, I don't offend them, but they, like, I think it's what you're saying. Like, after I do it, I think they kind of feel like, was that shade?
Yeah. Oftentimes, no, you're just being a little self-conscious, because that's the thing. There are like social organizational behavior studies that basically say that whenever we approach an interaction, we always underestimate our own influence. And that's another thing I really love about marketing is I have data and, like, you know, customer journeys. I can see the influence that I've had over, like, things I've written. And it's a, like, you know, I get, going back to data privacy, people feel like it's creepy. And it's not that I want to be creepy. I want to know whether a blog I wrote, you know, resonated with people, or whether I need to, like, write about something else. You know, it's that sort of stuff. And that's kind of like, you know, me as somebody who's conscious of social justice, but also, you know, somebody who's participating in business, you know, those are the kinds of things I think a lot about. How do you merge like values and then like business leadership?
Yeah. And I think a lot of people throw, you know, us to the dystopian side of mega information, of super transparency, because the government and, you know, all that good stuff, the way it can be used badly. But there's definitely a utopian side to information as well. Having information about someone so that you know how to adjust to them, to help them win and be happier, that's a pretty good use of information.
Yeah. I have an idea. We could forge a new personality archetype right now, live, or whenever this goes up.
Okay, do it.
Are you ready?
All right. We're going to watch the birth of a new personality.
Okay, this is based on centuries of mythology and fantasy folklore. Many of you in the fantasy and Dungeons & Dragons community will be familiar with the race known as goblins. Recently, the companies that all do the Dungeons & Dragons gaming, they went through this big thing where they kind of rebranded all of their traditional evil races because... if you don't know this, goblins are coded as people of color in a lot of fantasy literature. Fun fact. So, you know, these fantasy, you know, publishers took it upon themselves to say, hey, that's not cool. Let's change things. And they did. Now, I have figured out just kind of like how goblins have been interpreted in the media. What kind of person in real life would be a goblin?
All right, let's hear it.
They are people who are usually misunderstood. So a lot of queer people tend to be of the goblin type. There are also people who work within and outside of systems very well. They tend to be a lot of, like, you know, neurodivergent people, like ADHD thinkers, who tend to think in, you know, very broad areas and can see connections between very, very different fields, those kinds of people. And the third, like, most important trait is they care a lot about social equity because, you know, they are from communities that were not supported by the systems that we had growing up. And so that is what I think a modern goblin is.
I'm in. I like it.
Yeah. Just invented it right now.
Just like that. See? Yep. That's what happens when you get a lot of ideas flying around in enclosed spaces. Some of them bang into another atom up here, and wow, there's a new idea.
Do you want the full backstory for how I came up with that idea?
Sure.
Because obviously, you know, I had the concept. I just didn't have a platform to announce it before.
Yeah, go ahead. Excavate for us a little bit. Do some mental excavation.
The live rhetoric marketing communications podcast, only on Rhetoric Warriors.
You are the first person I've had on this podcast that actually markets. I like it. Everybody else just talks, and you're doing a nice blend of talk and marketing.
Well, that's, you know, we've been talking a lot about the ways people give and receive feedback. And that's part of it, is you can do it in a fun and creative way that doesn't put people to sleep. You could do it as a podcast, and it works. And I mean, that's really the thing, you know, that's the type of thing that a goblin would do, is they would be like, well, I met this guy like 20 minutes ago, but sure, I'll go on this podcast. It's the type of thing a burnt out PhD who, you know, launches a Rhetoric Warriors podcast. You know, very goblin behavior.
Yeah. I could trying to think of all the goblins that I've seen in different movies and how they do things. I guess the Green Goblin is the big goblin, right?
Yeah. Well, a lot of them are, you know, typically portrayed as primitive cultures, and then they adopt like a lot of like tribal, you know, imagery, which that's why, you know, goblins are racist, because tribal cultures are actually very complicated. Brief history lessons, queer history. A lot of tribal cultures actually had a lot of concepts related to gender fluidity. And then, you know, many Native American tribes, they, you know, queer and non-binary people who didn't really fit anywhere like in the binary male female, they were actually, you know, respected as a class of people in a lot of places. And so, you know, that's the interesting thing I think about, you know, language and the way media has influenced things, is that a lot of people think all of these ideas and pronouns and identities, they're new, but they're not. People have been like, you know, exploring these things and writing about them, you know, since the dawn of communication, basically.
Yeah, that shows up in Little Big Man, right? By Thomas Berger, the Dustin Hoffman movie, the non-binary within the Native American communities. I remember watching that movie and they turned it into a comedy. But then I read the book in a postmodern novel course where he really broke down all the things that Berger was doing to break down, you know, these strong identity structures. And he's like, well, look at the way, you know, all tribes, there's some great anthropology and ethnography on tribalism that really gets into some smart analysis of where we are right now. But that one about, oh, you never see this appear in any traditional American story about this community. But look what happens when you break it apart, you add this in, and it just deconstructs everything around it.
Yeah, I love it. And technically, I graduated with a degree in that, because that's just basic like literary analysis. And speaking of things you can do with an English degree, a lot of things, actually.
Yeah, you can actually think.
Yeah, I didn't actually have any formal market research training when I started my very lovely market research job. You know, I learned what I could about like data analysis. I started like talking to people in the industry. I got my hands on a few like reports and started teaching myself like what do analysts talk about. And from there, it was just literary analysis, but applied to data instead of words.
Yeah, it's the ability to look at texts or any kind of artifact or observe any type of activity, extract the structures, and then replicate those structures for yourself. And then extend those structures so that you then take over from the people that you got it from, because they are not innovating. Usually they're using standard practice. Once you absorb their stuff, you can rocket right past them because they're staying where they are. I learned this in comedy writing, where when I first got TV jobs, again, I'd never worked in TV. I'd never worked on staff. I'd never done group comedy writing. I got there and instantly go, okay, I've got to learn quick. Because you're on 13-week contracts and on late night talk shows, I can fire you for no reason at all after 13 weeks and just not renew your contract. But I found the best writers, in fact, every writer, and I'd start to absorb all their techniques, because you can observe it and then you can use it and then you can beat them at it so that they get fired instead of you.
That is true. That's basically what search engine optimization is, you know, more or less about. Like, there's a lot of technical details and stuff, but more or less it's, you know, what other people are saying the same things that I want to say on the internet, and how can I say those things better and more comprehensively?
Yeah. So talk a little bit more about your career stuff. Like, let's ground this a little bit more in your actual business experience.
Linear trajectory.
No, we're just pulling you back. We're going the way back. It's circular trajectories.
Yeah. That's the important part of editors, folks, because that's what they do. So, you know, I guess like my career in earnest probably got started in like 2007-ish. I was still in college back then, but I was interested in writing, just didn't know what kind of writing I wanted to do. So I tried being a student journalist out. found I really liked it. I'd never taken a journalism course before, but they didn't have any writers because they don't pay writers very well, it turns out, in most industries.
Yeah, well, you know, we don't need those writers to be sharing information.
Yeah, but, you know, I put up with it. You know, writing was an early business sector at the time, so there weren't too many opportunities in marketing, you know, just for writers, you know, yet. But that was foreshadowing, by the way. There are opportunities coming later. So, you know, I got through college, did like the student newspaper. I kind of said I was like moonlighting as a college student, and my real like education was the student news. And, you know, I'm half joking with that. There were really good teachers who impacted me in the way that I think and the way that, you know, I learn. But by and large, and I think, you know, a lot of people are like this, I needed the experience to really learn what I was doing and, you know, define what I wanted to do with my work. And, you know, I found education pretty frustrating from that perspective, because it forces you to spend a lot of money to explore different things. And so, you know, that kind of rose as just, you know, a passion area that I cared about was, you know, education should be easier and more affordable.
What?
I know, weird.
Get these democratic ideas out of here. They don't belong in the TARDIS.
But yeah, I know, it's insane. We're supposed to be objective on Doctor Who. That's how you see if you ask
how come they don't do like sequels, Dr. Witch, Dr. Why, Dr. How.
We just created an infinite number of Doctor Who spinoffs. You're welcome, BBC. So yeah, you know, it was kind of like, you know, messing around, figuring out what I wanted to do, not really being sure, but slowly starting to accumulate passions and interests and, you know, skills and people I could learn from.
Let me ask you this, because I had the same experience as an undergrad. Like, I started writing as an undergrad. I did PR writing and advertising writing, and I was a journalist / English double major. So I did these jobs and hated them so with such a passion, because they were so restrictive in how they wanted you to write. And it was really just collating information and then flowing it out in a basic communication pattern. They didn't want it super flavored, and I like super flavored writing. So I just balked at everything. And that's how one day I was like, I don't want any of these jobs. And I was walking past a professor's office that I'd had, and he was a young guy, I just started. I'd had him for two classes and I liked him. So I walked in and sat down in his chair, and he's like, what's up? I'm like, what am I going to do now? Like, I don't want any of these jobs. And he's like, go to grad school. And I'm like, what's that? You know, first generation college. I'd never heard any of this stuff. Yeah. Next thing I know, I was at the University of Texas in rhetoric.
Wow. Yeah. I actually had a similar experience, but even further back in high school, when I entered this biology class, and it was very clear that the teacher of this biology class should have retired like 5 years ago, because none of her information was updated with like any modern science.
Is she now a biology experiment herself, like in decay? Just watch the decay in the teacher.
Yeah, I mean, she's probably well past life at this point. Like, she, I don't even know, like, you know, back then, it was a long time ago. But anyway, you know, as an edgelord Hot Topic shopping teenager, I realized that this was going to be a problem for my ability to contribute positively to her class. So, you know, I did actually, in hindsight, probably one of the most adult things I ever did as a 17-year-old. I walked down to the high school counselor's office. I said, is there some way we could, you know, get me out of this class and find something else, because this teacher is terrible and we're not going to be productive. There's not going to be learning. And I was just honest about it, you know, as honest as I could be as an anxious teenager. We ended up finding, you know, some just way to get into like the entrepreneurship kind of like class of study by like studying like small businesses and, you know, doing like, you know, stuff with, you know, my restaurant job with like the owner and stuff to like think about business plans and like long-term stuff. Very, very clean and easy solution. The problem is not a lot of people have really awesome high school counselors and, you know, advisors who will tell them things like that and, you know, help them navigate the system.
I'm going to interject one more story just because you said that. My high school guidance counselor was named Dick Cooper. He was a Army grad, and I walked into his office after he got my ACTs back, and he's like, I can get you into any of the academies you want to go. Which academy you want to go to? I'm like, military academy? He's like, yeah. I'm like, I'm not going to a military academy, dude. And he ended up shoveling me to University of Dayton because it was an engineering, a really good engineering school, and it's a private college. And I wanted to go to Western Kentucky. He's like, no, that's a degree mill. Turns out Western Kentucky has one of the best TV programs in the country. And University of Dayton is just a bunch of engineers. So
yeah,
bad advice, Dick Cooper.
Yeah. Speaking of shopping for colleges, folks, do your homework, because even in the same university, different departments operate very differently. They focus on different things. Because the thing is, when you get at the PhD level, you're like one of like 50 people in the world who does what you do. And so, you know, between different universities and departments, there's a lot of versatility. There's a lot of different areas of expertise. And so you really do want to like do your homework, find out who the people are.
Yeah. Go do your homework, 17-year-olds. You figure it out.
Yeah. And while you're figuring all that out, by the way, get a job, figure out your entire future, get married, have kids, decide your spirituality. You know, go all out. You know, why not decide all that before you're
20? And then at about 40, just go, I made all the wrong decisions, and bail out and start over.
Yeah. You know what I like about just stupid off the cuff statistics?
What?
The failure rate of startups in the United States and the failure rate of marriages in the United States, roughly equal, about 50%.
Good one.
Yeah.
You want to hear a statistic that you haven't heard?
I do.
It's estimated like 87% of bar fights, of fights, would be eliminated if they get rid of parking lots.
I believe that. Parking lots have caused a lot of problems just in the bar community.
Yeah, you don't want to let the bar environment spill over into an unbound environment.
Yeah, the really fun crossover is when you're somebody who is used to like a bar environment, but used to work for a very family-friendly restaurant, third shift. Let me tell you, third shift at a family restaurant, very different experience from the, morning brunch crowd.
Yeah, that's drunk shift, right? That's the drunk coming to eat.
That is like the drunk shift, the sick shift, the sometimes just completely empty, boring shift. Like it's a lot of variety. You either have a nightmare of a time, or it's like really boring and fine.
It's like the ER of restaurants.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Keep going. You were in high school, I think.
Okay. No, we were in college.
We made it to college. Okay.
Yeah. I talked about my student journalism. I won second place in some statewide investigative journalism competition.
Really? What'd you investigate?
How students felt about the online meal program at University of Michigan, which is run by a company, or at least used to be run by a company called Sodexo. Turns out people had mixed feelings about it. Some people were cool with it. Like if they could afford extra food and stuff in addition to like their tuition, they were happy to sign up for a meal plan. The problem at the time was that people were forced to sign up for the meal plan, and it just added extra money onto their tuition. And that's like what people were upset about. It turns out you can win awards just by talking to people and seeing what they feel about an issue.
Well, good for you. I ran the student newspaper at a small Presbyterian all-female college in the South for 2 years, and they were not ready for liberal journalism.
Yeah, well, neither was U of M back then. My editor shot down anytime I wanted to cover something from the LGBTQ club that we had. And my beat back then was like campus features. So it was literally my job to cover club stuff. But something a club was doing that was sanctioned by the university, too spicy for the newspaper.
Yeah, it's a bizarre world when you get into actual academics. And I wandered through different universities for 20 years. So I've seen a lot of the different administrations and the actual workings of universities. But when I was there at that college, I let the students, she was a freshman, she was a really smart student. She wanted to do an expose on, part of the rule at that college was you had to get 4 cultural experiences, something like that, a year.
Yeah.
And so they defined culture for them as ballet and opera and stuff like that. And she went to a punk show. and wrote about that. And she's like, why isn't that culture? And yeah. Which doesn't sound at all, you know, controversial in the wide world itself, but there you might as well have set off a bomb in the conservative campus. How dare you? How dare you criticize this longstanding tradition? And I had to have a public forum over whether to shut down the newspaper.
Wow. That is intense. I never got something that intense, that quite that crazy, but I did play around with a very specific professor who I had figured out was of the more conservative persuasion. And the thing that people don't always get about conservative media, particularly in the United States, rated R sexually bad, rated R violently, that's fine. And so like I would play off of that in my like English assignments. Like one day I would write something about, oh, I met the sadist at the, you know, BDSM, you know, meetup. And it's not like, you know, you go through like just talking with each other and hanging out, but consent is very important to that community. So it's not the same as assault. And, you know, when I would talk about that, I would present it that way because, you know, I'm not the author of 50 Shades, just the way it is.
What about the 51st shade? Where'd that one go? See, once again, the numbers.
Infinite sequels. Don't give her any more ammunition, please, Dan. We do not need more 54. We don't need any more movies, Dan.
She's like with the vampire community, what's her face writing about that.
Don't say her name out loud.
I wasn't gonna, but it's like, you know, anybody that comes in and fictionalizes from like a distance and doesn't really get it right, man, you might as well just walk in with pariah on your forehead for that community.
Yeah, exactly. But I, you know, that's kind of what it is. It's like there's this ebb and flow of media interaction that creators don't seem to understand. Some of them do. Like, you know who is one of the most brilliant marketers of our time? Lil Nas X.
Yeah, black guy doing cowboy stuff.
Yeah.
Gay black guy, right?
Yeah, I actually just covered that in a market research report on a, you know, weekend where I met you, actually, same weekend.
It's a gorgeous, like, so co-optation and I can never remember the second word for it, but co-opting other narratives, like your enemy's narratives, inhabiting them, like going back into them and stealing their narrative and putting your stuff in it. It's nefarious at the level of politics. It's beautiful at the level of politics, like when it works in the right direction.
We should pitch something to Lil Nas. Like, what should he cover next? What do you think, Dan?
Well, you know, Madonna was always accused of going the other way, of going in and stealing from marginalized communities and then making all the money off of it, like with Vogue and that kind of stuff. He's stealing from traditional American communities and bringing it back into the marginal, which again, when you actually start to look at the way communication works and the complexity of the interplay of it all, it gets a lot more interesting as a narrative than you're co-opting culture because, you know,
that's true.
You're singing, you're a Puerto Rican singing blues or R&B. I'm like, it's more complicated than that.
I'll put on my diversity hat real quick. Mild disclaimer, cultural appropriation is wrong. The difference between using somebody's culture respectfully and cultural appropriation is how you profit and benefit from how you use that culture and whether or not you respect and cite your sources.
Yes, slippery gap in between those two.
It's a very complex and nuanced issue, but generally, if you think about it critically long enough, you can figure it out. And if you're not sure, in fact, even if you are sure, ask somebody from those communities and they'll tell you.
Well, and that's an interesting idea too. And I've got a 22-year-old daughter and she's been in professional makeup for a long time. And so she knows the trans community and the drag community really well. And I've taken her to a bunch of shows here. And then she tries to train me to the language, the proper language for those communities. And the thing about communities and cultures is that they are nuanced and they are complex. And somebody like me can't just come in from the outside, get a couple instructions from my daughter, who's also kind of still outside. And then be adept. I'm like, no. Culture is more than this. And then you can't judge me on my lack of adeptness with this stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, both sides, I think, have to like slow down and give each other space to make mistakes. Like, I think me in particular, I sit at like an intersection of marginalization and privilege. You know, I'm queer, but
there's some streets, man.
Yeah, we're going to talk about intersectionality. We're going all the way. We're gonna solve a lot of problems on this podcast.
I have those too, by the way. I'm gonna pull out mine when you're done here. I'm gonna explain to you my intersections of where I've been marginalized and entitled.
Do you know how I know that you were probably going to bring that up? I read it on your blog.
Really? Which yeah, one? Where at?
The Reddit Warriors one. It was just like, you know, bits and pieces about, what was it, growing up in Kentucky? Is that it? Yeah. It's that kind of stuff.
Southerners, definitely marginalized.
Yeah. And that's the easiest way to figure out what's important to a community and how they identify with themselves. Listen for a while. And then if you have questions, find somebody who's willing to talk to you and then ask that person and, you know, keep connecting with more people in the community and you'll get like a good, you know, high level view of at least what's important to a small subset of them.
Or you can go into their China shop and just shake your bull horns around and you'll discover all the problems as well.
Yeah. You'll definitely get a lot of attention, maybe not the attention you want, but.
Well, that's Trump. I mean, Trump knows that, you know, bulls get the most attention in a China shop. And so ergo, always be the bull.
Yeah. You know, the problem with that approach, Dan, is sustainability.
Oh, he's eating the seed corn of culture. He's burning all the bridges, all the fields. And at a certain point, it's all going to be gone and you can't cause any more trouble. That's why he kept running into more and more issues. That's why towards the end there, he was about to pull out the military because he had no other new ways to create trouble.
Yeah. And like big important part of, you know, just polarization and things like that, the way, you know, he manipulated the media and everything is he's, you know, tapping into like primal fear. He's separating people into tribes. When you think about it, it's dictatorship 101. What do you do when you want to take control over, you know, a large group of people? You make them focus on their differences. You make them focus on the reasons they hate each other. But like, you know, there's a lot of things I have in common with some of the most diehard conservatives on the face of the planet. At least one thing, no matter one thing.
Complex humans always have. I watch this like in the Dick Cheney's Daughters, you know, Liz, is it Liz who's the politician? Mm-hmm. And then her sister is lesbian, and for years wouldn't accept her. They wouldn't accept her, and now she's like, "Yeah, I made a mistake," and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. And I'm like, "Yeah, that's the problem when you have siblings who are, you know, from something that you've taken a political stance against. Eventually, the siblingness is going to come back around and go, I've been an asshole. I'm sorry."
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I thought of the perfect example right now. You know who Bernie Bros hate, Dan?
Many people.
Bernie Bros?
They hate.
Who do they hate?
Many of people.
Who do many Bernie followers dislike strongly, Dan?
You mean like, are you asking me to pluck one?
Yeah, just pick one. Who do they hate probably more than anybody else right now?
I don't know.
Bernie Sanders supporters. There's like two people possible this could be, right? Who do conservatives hate more than anybody? One of those two people.
Easy. Nancy Pelosi?
Okay, three people. Sometimes I forget AOC? About Nancy. Some Bernie, you know, fellows do get along with AOC, though.
Who would they hate? I haven't tracked this one very closely. I was never that interested in Bernie.
Joe Biden. Nobody hates Joe Biden more than Bernie people.
Is that because he beat Bernie?
Because he beat Bernie.
Yeah. Stuff to watch.
Now, what people don't understand about that situation is that the conservative media have a very large and very well-funded hate machine. And when you become the Democratic presidential elect, they then aim that hate machine at you. And so, you know, maybe Bernie would have been able to do better and accomplish more if he had beat Hillary Clinton back then or had, like, you know, made an stronger appearance in the most recent election. But nobody can really tell because, you know, the lots of billions of dollars of hate media were named at him.
Yeah, that's part of the thing, you know, like, well, let's not veer off into politics because we veered so much. I have millions and millions of points to make up politics, yeah. But I'll tell you what,
no, it was a good little tangent because it was related. Yeah.
I love it. I would talk about it forever. But we're coming up on an hour. What I want to do is I want to find just a place to tie off, and then we're going to come back and do like volumes 2, 3, 4, and 5.
Okay.
So let's just stay on the career path. You were just out of college, right? And your first marketing job.
Yeah, first marketing job. I had freelance for a little bit, but my first like full time job was about 2 years after college. Was at a content marketing agency. And if you're not familiar with what a content mill is in my industry, it's a very exploitive company that forces writers to produce an unfair amount of content.
The sweatshops of writing, right?
Yeah, back then the standard was 4,000 words a day. Mind you, we were back on the technology desk at this very anonymous but easy to find company.
Sounds like shade. I don't know, but that sounded a little shady.
Shadish. You know, Dan, this is a great example of why you should treat your employees well, because you never know when your former employees might show up on a rhetoric podcast.
Yeah, you're right. And yeah. I think, you know, if the truth is slandery, it's not my fault.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's only slander if it's fake. So what I'm describing right now, 4,000 words a day, it's no longer the process that they use, so it's no longer proprietary. And I haven't named anyone, so it would be a very expensive legal nightmare to come after me anyway. Long story short, 4,000 words a day. I wrote for the technology desk, which meant I had to like research and understand like cloud infrastructure and like mainframe computers and, you know, SaaS applications. And if you don't know what any of those things mean, neither did I. But I had to learn very quickly because I had about 20 minutes to write 200 words. When I joined this job, as you can imagine, the content was never that great. However, what I learned is this agency was giving me access to a lot of other brands with much bigger platforms and better looking resume credentials than the brand itself. So what I did was I just started, you know, focusing most of my energy on projects that I felt really good about. And then I felt like I could showcase my best work. I put all my energy into those and started building a portfolio. And while I was building that portfolio, I started looking for other job opportunities because, you know, places like that, you have about 6 months before you start really feeling the burn.
Yeah, I call it, it's like the car lot, used car salespeople. They bring them in, let them sell to all their friends, and then they burn out and they fire them.
Yeah, and it's turn and burn employees. In that environment, we literally did have a joke when somebody resigned, you know, and people asked where they were, we would be like, oh, they've moved on to a better place. Because it was true.
All right. That's a good spot. I like it. We're going to stop here in the sweatshop. We'll come
perfect.
Back. We'll come back to the sweatshop in volume 2 of this. Anything you want to say to tie off your side of the, you want to, you know, tell people where you're heading in the TARDIS right now or?
Well, right now I'm doing a lot with my work at All Campus. I chair an accessibility employee resource group, which is just an employee-led organization that like has support from the company. So we get like a budget and all the cool things that come with being like an organizational function. So we're only like a year old, so we've only done like a little bit of fundraising. We raised a couple $1,000 for a group called like Little Friends earlier this year, which is like an autism advocacy group, and they help place people in like careers and help them build skills and stuff like that. So relatively new kind of thing. We're still figuring a lot of it out, but you know, one of the things we found across these ERGs is it gets people talking honestly and authentically about issues. And it doesn't mean that nobody ever disagrees. It doesn't mean that nobody gets pissed off or upset, but what it means is that we, as a company, have agreed to come together and talk about the things you're not supposed to talk about at work. So far, it's worked out pretty well.
Cool. That's awesome. We'll definitely circle back and talk about that one too.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a big initiative. And of course, you know, in addition to all the other stuff that happens as at a company, you know, we're a mid-sized organization. We do a lot of branding. I do a lot of freelance consulting. I've got a lot of contacts back across like agencies and clients that, you know, I really enjoyed working with that I'm still in touch with. So if you have a freelance project or want to be audited, as Dan would say, you know, get in touch. I'm basically at the point where I'm doing the side quests of my career, where I've got like the main job and focus that I want, but you know, everything else is passion projects and things that I care about. So the only reason I'm going to know if we're going to work well together is if you tell me what you care about.
Yeah. Good structure. I like it. Well, awesome. We will circle back around and we'll do some more of these, lots and lots to talk about. Love it when I find other natural, you know, rhetoricians in the world who may not have completely labeled themselves as rhetoricians, yet they are.
Yeah, that's the, what is, how much time does it take to be considered a master of something, Dan? Do you know off the top of your head? There's like a number, hours.
It depends on if you're an idiot. Like,
that is true.
It's been 20 years or something. You can be more efficient.
But I'm talking just in terms of like, in case rules lawyers challenge us later, there's like 10,000 hours or something like that.
I used to, like in stand-up, it's 10 years. You have to do stand-up for 10 years before you're good at it.
All right. So folks, 10 years, you can be a master of anything as long as you have some verifiable evidence that you've been doing it for 10 years.
Yeah. And in rhetoric.
And that, you know, people like you.
And in rhetoric, since you can be slippery and approach evidence in many different ways, you have all sorts of options for proving your mastery.
True.
Which is also very useful.
That's the beauty of rhetoric, is you become better at persuading people that you are a master.
You know, it starts with just putting it in front of your name, master rhetorician.
Yeah. Also, don't be afraid of a CTA button.
Yeah, it's just an adjective. Like, master is just an adjective, and CTAs are just commands. That's all it is.
Sometimes people like being told what to do because it's clear what they need to do in order to give you money.
Well, one of the things I tagged at the beginning of this was the newsletter on persuasion for parents, because I've been working on it as a book or a slide deck or a talk. And like, eventually it's just I have too many projects going on. So it's better for me to just start writing it, rolling it out. But this one started with, and it's in the first or the second newsletter, that if you want to use command and control over your children, if you want to be king mom or queen dad, whatever you want, and you want them, you know, the whole game is you say it and they must respect it, or they have become an immoral entity, then go ahead. But what they're going to end up doing is using that same system back on you. And human beings are great at being deviant within command and control. They're horrible at being deviant within rhetoric, because rhetoric just keeps morphing around them. And they like keep trying to punch it and like, I thought I had it. And no, I'm just over here now. It's like that kind of disappearing character.
Yeah, that's important. People underestimate how just powerful deciding to, you know, write one word instead of another could be, even if it's a blog. And I only know this because I spend all day looking at the data, and we've done headline tests. You can change whether or not somebody clicks on a form just by changing a word in a headline.
Yeah. And it's cool. It's not nefarious or manipulative to say, I want to use the best language possible to get effects with people so that we all get to a good place. I'm not just trying to sell you a widget. I'm trying to sell you really good ideas.
Yeah, exactly. And if you have found a marketer who is ethical about it, you'll be able to tell, because unethical marketers, they fall apart under scrutiny of any kind because they're not willing to like challenge their assumptions.
Yeah. You're looking for ethical and talented. If you can find that, like somebody who's morally committed to good outcomes and talented at getting those, hire that person, pay them a lot of money and never let them go.
Literally fight for that. If another organization offers something to them, fight your finance department and get more money for that person.
Yeah, because that they're going to pay off in ways that you can't even imagine right now. And I say 100%. This to people a lot. Like, again, I move back and forth between like stand-up and marketing and rhetoric, but in stand-up, I call them marquee bits. They're game changers. If you write a certain bit, like Jim Gaffigan did, went from, you know, probably a $2,500 a week stand-up wrote Hot Pockets, Hot Pockets, and did like a 7-minute bit on it, changed his career forever. Yeah. He became, you know, $100,000 a show comedian. Yeah. And that's one marquee message. So that's
important. The part about the Hot Pockets bit is that he was also transparent that he understood the game, because he had an entire bit about people asking him, why don't you advertise for Hot Pockets? And he just did his Hot Pocket bit over again and said, that's why.
Yeah. You know, he was advertising himself by anti-advertising Hot Pockets. So
yeah, exactly.
Great stuff. All right, man. Well, I appreciate it. Super fun. We will come back.
Yeah, it was awesome. Thank you.
All right. And this has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Get out there, persuade some people. They need it. You should be good at it. Let's all do it.